I'd like to give a brief overview and introduction to Confucianism, one of the most impactful of all our human institutions, certainly one of the most impactful ethical, philosophical, social, and religious systems we have. It's been dominant throughout much of China for much of the last 2,500 years, and it's spread through much of East Asia, especially Korea and Japan, where it also has had a very powerful impact. Confucius himself was born in 551 BC to humble circumstances. He lived until 479 BC, dying at the age of 72. So he lived about the time of the Buddha and Socrates and about 500 years before Jesus. He was probably largely self-educated, and he was deeply committed to learning. As he himself said, "There are bound to be those who are my equal in doing their best for others and in being trustworthy in what they say, but they are unlikely to be as eager to learn as I am. Perhaps it might be said of me that I learn without flagging and teach without growing weary." And when a governor asked what kind of man Confucius was, one of his students was at a loss for words, and Confucius suggested, "Why did you not simply say something to this effect? He is the sort of man who forgets to eat when he tries to solve a problem that has driven him to distraction, who is so full of joy that he forgets his worries, and who does not notice the onset of old age." The kind of learning he sought was obviously not mere facts, but really wisdom. And the sacred question he addressed was a very specific one. Whether we know it or not, each of us has a central question for our lives, and to some extent the depth and meaning of our lives is a function of how much we recognize and wrestle with our sacred question, how deeply we think about it, how much we ponder it, and the depths to which we are able to answer it. For Confucius, his sacred question was clearly something like, how do we live wisely and well and contribute most effectively to others? It's a beautiful question. And his focus, or the answers he gave, focused on four things: on relationships and how to optimize them, on living ethically, on good government, and on how one becomes a shunzi, which is loosely translated in some older translations as a gentleman. It means actually a refined or wise person, not a full sage, but someone who's heading in that direction. In line with his emphasis on society and relationships, he placed great emphasis on ritual, which was an important element of Chinese social life then and now. And he laid great emphasis on this, but he also reframed or up-leveled it, using it as a means for self-cultivation. That is, he up-leveled it from a conventional approach, which merely tries to observe the rules and do so in order to be a good person or look good. This he up-leveled to a post-conventional stance in which the rituals are used as a means of inner refinement and inner cultivation and personal maturation. He lived in a time of great social chaos, and having, in part probably because he'd been born to humble circumstances himself, he was acutely aware of the suffering of the masses and yearned to find a place in government where he could institute ethical principles and effective government to benefit the people. So he walked from state to state looking for employment, but had only limited success. He did achieve some minor positions, but he also left court in disgust, after realizing that, seeing the intrigues and realizing how little impact his words and ethical principles were having. And eventually gave up, but and in his own time was regarded as somewhat of a failure, since attaining a government position was regarded as a great good for anyone who wanted to be of benefit. But he turned his attention to teaching and was effectively a one-man university, and uniquely he accepted students from all classes of society, and they became his students and effectively his disciples. And through them, his influence has radiated through 100 generations. His emphasis, again, was relational. And so Confucianism became a relational, ethical, political, and philosophical system. So his orientation was relational and social. Relational in the micro sense, social in the macro sense. And the great religious scholar Houston Smith makes an interesting observation about different cultures and the directions of their focus. He points out that in the West, our primary focus has been outward, towards the world, towards material triumph and success. In India, on the other hand, at least traditionally, the primary focus was inward, towards self exploration, self-understanding, self-cultivation, and self-transcendence, ultimately. But in China, he suggests, the primary orientation has been relational and social, towards others. Now, Confucianism has an interesting relationship to religion, because for much or most of its history, it really wasn't a full religion. And by full, I mean it wasn't oriented to self-transcendence, what we would now commonly call awakening, enlightenment, or salvation. And it lacked several of the seven essential practices, which, as far as I can see, are essential for any effective transformational program or spiritual program aimed at self-transcendence. And these seven essential practices, and I laid them out in the book Essential Spirituality, but just to name them, they are ethics, which Confucianism certainly had, emotional transformation, which it also had, that is the reduction of painful, destructive emotions like fear and anger and jealousy, and the cultivation of beneficial pro-social emotions such as love and compassion and joy. The third key practice is redirecting motivation, and that means essentially reducing craving and attachment and redirecting motivation away from an attachment to material goals and attainments to more subtle goals such as self-actualization, service, self-transcendence. And then there is the practice of developing concentration and of perceptual refinement. These two practices really usually come out of a contemplative practice, and Confucianism did not have a contemplative wing in its early phase. So there weren't practices for concentration and perceptual refinement. The seventh practice is wisdom. Cultivation of wisdom, and this clearly Confucianism had, though wisdom of a particular kind, life wisdom, and not necessarily transcendental wisdom that comes from deep contemplative inquiry. And finally, service to others. This is the culminating practice of the seven central practices, and clearly this was a major goal and value for Confucianism. So we could say that they had, in their initial years or centuries, five of these seven practices, but it wasn't yet a full spiritual practice or tradition because it lacked the contemplative practices. If you want to think of an analogy, you could think of the Greco-Roman ethicists such as the Stoics and the Epicureans, who obviously were aiming at living the good life and had a very sophisticated ethical system and aimed at what they called apatheia or ataraxia, which is a kind of calm and equanimity. But again, they really didn't have a systematic contemplative practice for attaining the most profound levels of calm and equanimity or for self-transcendence, at least in its fuller expressions. Now, one of the key questions that you find in Confucianism and in any thinking person and any spiritual tradition is about the fundamental nature of human beings. And one of the key questions is human nature good or evil? It's one of the great recurrent questions throughout history. And we could phrase it as saying, is human nature basically or essentially or fundamentally good or evil? Now, just to get my own bias out of the way, I would say that most of the arguments, and there have been lots of arguments throughout history, occur because people haven't thought deeply enough, haven't introspected deeply enough, and haven't defined their terms clearly enough. What does fundamental mean? What is actually meant by human nature? Often people are talking about very different levels and kinds of or aspects or facets of human nature. Confucians have come down on both sides of this. On the one hand was the great sage Mencius, who argued that human nature is basically good. And the other was Hunza, who argued that human nature is basically malevolent or evil. Mencius is regarded as the second great Confucian sage. He lived from about 372 to 289 BC, so he lived during the 4th and 3rd centuries, overlapping with, say, Plato. He based his idea of goodness on our basic feelings, and he said, quotes, "Man's nature has endowed it with feelings which impel it towards the good. All men have the feelings of sympathy, shame, respect, and the recognition of right and wrong. These feelings give rise to benevolence, righteousness, propriety, and wisdom." So what he's basically saying here is that all of us as human beings have four fundamental feelings, what he called seeds, and if these are cultivated, they become the four classic Confucian virtues. So the seeds are sympathy, shame, respect, and the recognition of right and wrong, and these flower into the virtues of benevolence, righteousness, propriety, and wisdom. So sympathy or empathy for others flowers into benevolence, which is Ren, the classic or greatest of all Confucian virtues. And shame is the basis or the seed for the virtue of righteousness, for acting morally, ethically. Respect is the seed which can flower into propriety, that is, following the mores or the ethical standards of the culture. And fourth, the recognition of right and wrong, Mencius regards as the birthplace or the seed of the virtue of wisdom. So for Mencius, self-cultivation and maturation involve cultivating and strengthening these four seeds until they flower into full virtues. Hunza, on the other hand, argued that humans are basically or fundamentally animal-like. They're instinctively driven by cravings, and these lead to all sorts of vices and violence. And therefore, self-cultivation is a matter primarily of overcoming our basic nature, not just cultivating it, but overcoming it. Now, these may seem like pedantic differences, but they're actually extremely important because our assumptions about human nature have enormous impact on us. First, they tend to act as self-fulfilling prophecies. That is, what we believe to be true tends to become true in our experience. So if we, for example, think of or regard other people as fundamentally malevolent, then we're likely to treat them that way, expect them to act that way, and probably they will, at least in part. Moreover, our beliefs about human nature determine how we see ourselves. For example, they decide whether we can trust ourselves. They determine how we see and relate to others. Can we trust them? They determine our ethical systems and emphases. Does our ethics focus on supporting the flowering of benevolence or on restraint and repression? And in the macro system, these assumptions have grave implications for government. For example, do we focus on education? And remember, the original term education meant educare, to lead out of. Do we attempt to lead out of or cultivate or actualize people's benevolent seeds, or do we focus on repression and punishment? Big difference. Gordon Allport, the great early 20th century psychologist, put it this way: by their own theories of human nature, psychologists have the power of elevating or degrading that same nature, debasing assumptions to base human beings. Generous assumptions exalt them. So this question of our fundamental nature leads to another question about our human potentials. And the way the Confucians phrased this was, can we all become sages? Is sagehood, becoming a truly wise, humane figure, a realistic goal for us? And for most of the 1500 years of Confucianism, the answer was no. We could improve ourselves, we could get better, we could uplift ourselves morally, but we could never really expect to attain the status of the earlier sages like Confucius and Mencius. That kind of negative view or limited view of our human potentials remained predominant for about 1500 years. And it wasn't until the second millennium of our era, with the rebirth of Confucianism in what is now called in the West Neo-Confucianism, that view really changed. Neo-Confucianism was a great synthesis. It was a synthesis of Confucianism, Taoism, which had long been a coexisting tradition in China, and a relative new upstart, Buddhism, which had arrived in China many centuries before and had gone in and out of fashion. But what basically happened was the Confucians, many of them studied both Taoism and Buddhism as well as Confucianism, saw that there was great wisdom in each tradition. In fact, there were several schools which spoke of themselves as three in one and viewed each of these traditions as a different expression of the same fundamental values and truths. And yet those whose primary affiliation was with Confucianism sought to assimilate the Taoist and Buddhist contributions into Confucianism. And this is an example of what we would now call assimilative integration. That is, these Confucians of around the 11th through 13th centuries assimilated what they thought of as the best of Taoism and Buddhism and integrated them into Confucianism, essentially enlarging Confucianism in the process and producing what is now known as Neo-Confucianism. The most famous person involved in this synthesis was Chu Xi. Pardon my pronunciation. There are different spellings of this. C-H-U-X-I is one of them. He was kind of the Ken Wilber of his time. That is a great integrative synthesizer. And for Chu Xi and other great Confucians of this time, there was now a re-evaluation of our potentials and possibilities, and it was regarded as quite possible for any of us, at least in potential, to become sages. And the challenge was to do the inner work that was necessary for that. And there now emerged a great split in the practical emphasis on sagehood. How does one become a sage? This, of course, is one of the great questions that every religious and many philosophical traditions wrestle with. For Chu Xi and his followers, the primary practice was study. Study and study and more study and reflection and discussion and more study of the great sages of the past, and particularly of the so-called four books, the Confucian Analects, the Great Learning, the Doctrine of the Mean, and fourth, the Book of Mencius. So one studied and reflected and applied these teachings, and also engaged in quiet sitting, a kind of Zen-like practice, somewhat similar to Shikantaza, not particularly goal-oriented, just a sitting and allowing experiences to emerge and settle. And the other major emphasis was what was called the investigation, or the investigation of principle. That is, when one was urged to investigate the underlying principle, or difficult concept to grasp and articulate, and I don't feel like I fully grasped the full meaning and significance myself, but the term principle implies the underlying structure that is at the core of an object, a kind of archetype or form, and also which can be shared with all existence. So the idea was that if one investigated and recognized the principle inherent in all things, one would recognize the universality and recognize the same principle in oneself. And this became the standard view for 800 years into the early 20th century. The trap of this emphasis on study is, of course, scholasticism, that people can get lost in scholastic minutiae and ignore underemphasize the transformative, elevating reflection and truth-seeking of study. The other approach to self-cultivation was particularly associated with Wang Yangming, who was a remarkable Renaissance man, a soldier, a statesman, a sage, and a person who had certainly a very varied career. He was a man of great courage who stood up for the truth and was willing to speak truth to power. That didn't do so well for him, and he was attacked and mercilessly flogged to the point of unconsciousness for his trouble. Then he was exiled for 3 years into the, quotes, lands of the barbarians, quotes. And there he attempted to put Chu Xi's investigation into practice and really committed himself to it very, very, very deeply. He himself wrote that, and I quote, "Everyone says that in investigating things one should use the method of Chu Xi, but how can it actually be done? I've tried to do it. And I discussed this with my friend Qian. I pointed to a bamboo in front of the pavilion and told him to investigate it. Day and night, Qian meticulously investigated the principle of the bamboo. For 3 days, he exhausted his mind until his mental energy was overtaxed and he became ill. At first, I said that this was because his strength was insufficient. I took up the task myself and investigated the bamboo early and late, but still I could not discover its principle. After 7 days, I too became ill because of having worn out my mind. So we sighed together and said, the reason we cannot be sages or worthy men is that we lack the great strength that is needed for the investigation of things. Later, however, while living among the barbarian tribes for 3 years, I came to understand that the task of investigating things has to do only with investigating one's own body and mind." Wang Yangming had an enlightenment experience during his exile. It said that his followers became ill and he cared for them and cooked for them and even sang songs to prevent them becoming depressed. And he wondered what method a sage would adopt if he were to find himself exiled in such difficult circumstances as these. And suddenly in the middle of the night, he realized the true meaning of the expression, investigate things so that knowledge may be extended to the utmost. The revelation, he said, was if someone had spoken to him, and without knowing what he was doing, he cried out and leaped out of his bed. All of his followers were frightened, but Wang said, "Now for the first time I understand the teaching of the sage. My nature is itself sufficient. To search for principles in affairs and things was an error." And that is a remarkable insight, to realize that my nature is in itself self-sufficient. One doesn't have to look outside oneself. That's one of the recurrent insights of great teachers and teachings. We don't have to look outside ourselves. The answers are within. So Wang Yangming brought this emphasis into the mainstream, and it had a major emphasis along with Chu Xi's investigation of external principle for many, many years. And Wang himself was clearly an extraordinary human being, a Renaissance man and a sage. So in overview, we have a teaching which took 1,500 years to become a full-fledged spiritual path. It started as an ethical, relational, political, and philosophical teaching which had enormous impact and still does. It became a popular ritualistic religion, but not for 1,500 years did it become a full spiritual discipline which included contemplative practices, so that eventually it became not just an inspiring ethical moral system, not just a benevolent political orientation, and not just a popular mythic and ritualistic religion, but also a path for awakening, enlightenment, and liberation. And one of the most impactful traditions in all of human history.